From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Our moderator is White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. Violence in Venezuela as forces loyal to the government of Nicolas Maduro fight rebel forces loyal to opposition leader Juan Guaido. Here in the United States, the top law enforcement official in the country testifies before lawmakers about the so-called Mueller report. There's a big new name in America's presidential election, former Vice President Joe Biden. President Trump and Democrats seem to agree on something: better infrastructure. And another shooting at a place of worship, this time a synagogue in the U.S. state of California. Well, let's start with this violence in Venezuela, the South American country. 32 million people descending further into chaos. Troops loyal to Maduro fighting it out with opposition forces loyal to Juan Guaido. Stephen Collinson of CNN, it looks like Maduro has been able for now to tamp down this opposition for now, though.
Right. It seems that there was some miscalculation by Guaido and potentially in the White House as well this week, because it looked like we were coming to the tipping point of this uprising against the Maduro government. The assumption from Guaido, and it seems to be senior U.S. officials, was that a number of generals were going to finally defect from Maduro and go over to Guaido. And Guaido called for this uprising, this revolt on the streets to try and push finally Maduro out of office. It didn't take place, though, so that makes you think that Maduro perhaps is a little bit more solid in power than a lot of people thought. There's a big debate going on in Washington, especially among U.S. allies, who think that perhaps the administration, led by people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State,
have you overplayed their hand?
Yeah, well, and they perhaps, they're seeing what they want to see, that they think that there's a chance for regime change here, and they're perhaps overestimating the chances of Guaido doing this quickly, although it may well happen in the long run.
You know, Molly, the thing about Venezuela that just fascinates me, vast oil reserves. They have bigger oil reserves than either the Saudis. A lot of people don't know that. So they're sitting on vast wealth, and yet this country is just poverty-stricken, food shortages, electricity flickering on and off. Why would anyone even support Maduro in the first place?
Well, Guaido's assertion is, in fact, that he won the presidential election that took place earlier this year, and that has been the basis of his challenge to Maduro. There have been protests in the streets against Maduro, as you mentioned. People are starving. There have been millions of refugees who have fled Venezuela because of the conditions there, blaming the socialist dictatorship of Maduro, who, of course, followed Hugo Chavez in that office. And so Guaido claims that Maduro did not win this recent election, that in fact it was rigged. There were indeed many irregularities. And so Guaido considers himself the rightful president of Venezuela. And many governments, including the United States, have in fact recognized him as the leader of Venezuela. But as Stephen said, he believed that he had enough support within the military. And this has been the big question in Venezuela, is which side is the military on? Because whoever they throw their support to is likely to be the person who stays in that presidential palace.
And, you know, Stephen, if you have the Russians on the other side, of course, who are backing Maduro pretty firmly, this is essentially a proxy war, if you will, between the United States and Russia. Tell us about that.
It almost makes you feel nostalgic for the Cold War in a way, you know. And this is a test case for U.S. foreign policy. The administration led by National Security Advisor John Bolton, who has been interested in Venezuela and the Western Hemisphere for decades. It's one of his big priorities, trying to get U.S. supporting governments in place in some of these countries. He's a hawk on Cuba as well as Venezuela. And it's no mistake that a few months ago, Bolton went down to Miami and gave this speech, which basically said, we're going to have the return of the Monroe Doctrine, 200-year-old doctrine, which was to outlaw colonialism by European nations in Central and South America. That was watched very closely in Moscow. The Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov, this week kind of referred to it in his rather sly and cynical way that the US was going back to this. But this is a test case for the kind of economic pressure, regime change policy that people in the administration like Bolton and Pompeo want to pursue, not just in Venezuela, but also in Iran. We're seeing exactly the same kind of logic being applied to Iran. Big sanctions, trying to incite an uprising so that the people perhaps one day may overthrow a tyrannical government. So it's very, very interesting geopolitically. And of course, it segues very nicely to the re-election campaign of Donald Trump, because he can talk about the Democrats are going left. We see socialism in Venezuela and see what that's what they want to do here.
Except speaking of Trump, though, I mean, there's a huge disconnect, the way I see it, at least. You remember when Trump ran in 2016, he kept saying, look, we can't be the world's policemen anymore. We've got to focus on our problems here at home. And yet here he is hinting about possibly sending U.S. troops to South America. How do you connect all that?
Well, Trump's rhetoric has always been a bit contradictory. He ran as a sort of militant isolationist, right? On the one hand, he said that the United States military is overextended and needs to come home. On the other hand, he vowed to kick the butt of ISIS, to put it nicely, and to exert maximum military strength around the globe. And so you see someone like Bolton seen within the administration as sort of cleverly maneuvering to get the president to back these kinds of very tough and potentially interventionist foreign policies. The question is going to be when and if these sanctions on Venezuela or on Iran are not effective in sparking an uprising, a revolution, regime change, is this administration going to take the next step and pursue military intervention? Bolton's reputation has always been to his detractors as a warmonger, as somebody who always wants to send the military and always wants the United States to exert military strength. And given the president's contradictory rhetoric on this, and you know, he does this on a lot of issues. He sort of says both things, and then people can hear what they want to. But at some point, they may have to decide.
Well, moving on, here in the U.S., the top law enforcement official for our global listeners is called the Attorney General. Right now, that's a man named William Barr. He clashed with the Senate panel recently over this so-called Mueller report. This is a huge report, 448 pages, 2 years in the making. Tell what happened for our listeners.
Well, the Mueller report, read in isolation, is quite damning for the president. But it also details this was an investigation into Russian interference in the United States election, and then looks at to what extent they may have collaborated with the Trump campaign. And the conclusion that's drawn is that while various figures around now President Trump were willing to accept help from the Russians, they didn't actually coordinate. There wasn't actually a conspiracy. At the same time, the president, during over the course of this investigation, you know, from firing the FBI director to various other actions that were taken, seemed to get in the way of the investigation. And Mueller's decision was, I'm not going to say whether this was a crime. I'm not going to say whether this constituted, under the statute, obstruction of justice. But I'm going to give you the facts of the case and let you, presumably Congress, draw your own conclusion. Rather than simply release the report, Barr first released a two-page summary that quoted very little of the actual report, but asserted his authority as the Attorney General to say, I don't think there was a crime here. Most of the report has been released. There are some redactions based on types of information that are secret, but there are discrepancies between the way that Barr characterized the report and the report itself, and so he was called to testify before the Senate. And the Democrats in Congress view the Attorney General as serving essentially to defend the president rather than to uphold the rule of law. And the House of Representatives would also like him to testify, but he has refused. So this may lead to a whole other battle between the administration and the Congress.
You know, one thing that came up during this testimony, Nancy Pelosi, the powerful Speaker of the House this week, flat out accused the Attorney General quite dramatically of lying, in other words, perjuring himself before the Congress. That's a crime. What happens now, Steve?
You know, we've been talking in Washington over the last couple of years about the possibility of a constitutional crisis. I mean, it seems like we might be getting to the precipice of that, because you have the Attorney General's obfuscation. I mean, he clearly appears to be more interested in acting as an associate of the president than necessarily trying to be an independent arbiter of this situation. You have an administration that is refusing subpoenas for officials and ex-officials to testify. The president is personally suing a congressional committee and his own accountants to stop the release of financial records. Now you have this situation where the Democrats are trying to force William Barr to testify. And when the Speaker of the House comes out and says there's been a crime committed, I mean, this doesn't happen very often. This is very, very unusual. It looks like what's going to happen is we are going to go into a series of protracted legal battles on multiple fronts. The Democrats have the ultimate sanction if they wish to use it, which is impeachment, to try and impeach the president in the House of Representatives. They don't appear, for political reasons, because they don't want to be seen as overreaching, they don't appear to want to go down that road. So the only real recourse they have to try and hold an administration to account is legal action. And that tells you a little bit about the administration's tactics. As long as they can keep all of these different strands of investigation held up in the courts, it's quite possible they could push them off for months, even beyond the general election in November 2020. So that's clearly what appears to be happening. But given the polarization and the partisanship in Washington, it seems very unlikely that Congress on its own is going to be able to solve this issue. And it's going to be down to the judicial branch on all these different issues to work out. And the ultimate question is, what is the extent of oversight of a sitting president who wants to flout that kind of investigation and oversight?
Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Did you know you can download the program? It's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. Our moderator is White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Welcome back. There's a big new name in America's presidential election, former Vice President Joe Biden. And I don't know about you guys, but I keep getting these emails from his campaign saying, well, let me introduce myself. My name is Joe Biden. He doesn't need any introduction. He's been in Washington for nearly half a century. It seems to me, Molly, the question is not who is Joe Biden, but why Joe Biden now?
Well, Joe Biden has been the front runner in this race since before he made up his mind to actually run in it. He's run for president twice before, but at those times he was a member of the United States Senate and not particularly well known. Since then, he served for 8 years as the vice president to President Barack Obama. And that, of course, put him on the radar of a lot more people. The Democratic Party generally has very warm feelings toward the former president and the former vice president. So having spoken to a lot of voters in the early voting states that will determine who becomes the Democratic nominee to run against Donald Trump in 2020, they are looking for a candidate who they believe can win and who can unify the party. But ideologically, there are some divisions within the Democratic Party. Biden is viewed as more moderate, more willing to work with the other side, not necessarily as far to the left on many of the issues that are important to the party. But as you mentioned, everybody knows who he is. There are 20 other major candidates at this point. It's a very large field, but none of them are as well known as he is. So at this point, he appears to have gotten a quite strong start, and he appears to be in a strong position, but we're still very early days in this primary.
You know, Steve, Molly mentioned something about how Biden, of course, has his reputation as a centrist. He praises people like Dick Cheney, which has gotten him in a little bit of hot water. These are things that modern Democrats or these progressives are aghast at. How big of a problem or behavior like this going to be for him?
It's the most interesting question, I think, of the Democratic campaign in many ways, because, as you say, Biden is someone that likes to work across party lines. He's a tactile politician. He's a centrist. He's in favor of a traditional US global leadership role in the world. Yet he's coming to run for president for the third time at a time when many of those qualities almost seem disqualifying in a Democratic Party that is now animated by forces of gender, of race, that's moving left on economic issues. So it's very interesting. And the question before, as Molly said, before Democratic voters is, do we care more about those issues, or do we care more about someone who's best positioned to beat President Trump in November? If you look at Biden's campaign, it's very interesting. He's known as this kind of blue-collar warrior. He's a big union man. That's his political base. But in his announcement, he was stressing that he was the person to kind of purge the Trumpism, if you like, from the United States. This habit the president has of tearing at social and racial and religious divides as a method of animating his base. Biden was saying, look, I'm the person that can get us back to what America used to be. And on the other hand, he put out an ad this week which featured President Obama praising him over and over again while he was in the White House. So Biden is actually running as the anti-Trump and the revival of Obama. Those seem to be the twin pillars of his re-election campaign right now. And the question is, Democrats want that, or are they more interested in financing college, healthcare for everyone, that kind of issue? And can he kind of merge those two strains of the party?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. And the one thing that you sort of talking about, it's a campaign almost of hope versus fear. But the question of Biden, you know, these days, the old adage about how, you know, you win the, you know, the nomination by going to either the right or left, and you win the general election by going back to the center. Well, that's sort of the reverse of what sort of where Biden is now. He's positioning himself right now as a centrist candidate. That's going to be trouble for him, wouldn't it?
Well, I think there is a misconception about the base of the Democratic Party. The base of the Democratic Party is still majority moderate and conservative. The progressives are about half. And now that's much bigger than they've ever been. But whereas Republicans are far and away majority conservative in terms of how their voters would describe themselves, only about half of Democrats consider themselves to be liberals. But the liberal activists definitely have disproportionate sway. And what we're going to see is when we start having these debates, when the activists start rating the different candidates, when Joe Biden utters things like saying he's friends with former Vice President Dick Cheney, do the activists react very strongly to that? Does that become disqualifying? I don't think we know. I think, as Stephen was saying, this is sort of uncharted territory because of Trump and because the Democratic Party has changed so much. There's a lot of energy in the base of the party. We saw that in the midterm elections in 2018. So it's really going to be a test of where is the heart of the Democratic Party right now. And then for Biden, he really just wants to stay where he is, since he's come out on top to begin with strong fundraising, with strong polling. He's trying to run against Trump rather than running against the other Democratic candidates in order to be seen as almost already the nominee.
And it's staggering, too, to Steve's point that, you know, reaching across the aisle, cooperating with the other side, it's just a terrible thing. And yet that's what he wants to do.
I don't think that's what people are holding against him. I think what people are holding against him is things like the Anita Hill hearings back in the 1990s, when he was viewed as cruel to a woman who accused a Supreme Court justice of sexual harassment, things like the crime bill of the Clinton years, things like his closeness to the finance industry and the credit card companies. So ideologically, he is much closer to the center. And those are the things that I think the left will hold against him.
Now, meantime, in case the two of you didn't know, it's been another infrastructure week. We've had a bunch of infrastructure weeks. Well, now we've had another one, the president meeting with the Democratic leaders. And this actually seemed to go pretty well. They're talking about upwards of $2 trillion in spending. But we've heard all of this for a long time. Everybody knows our roads and bridges, airports and so forth have to be repaired. The question is, what's actually going to happen and where's that money going to come from?
You know, infrastructure is this great idea in American politics that every president sees infrastructure as a way that the two parties can work together. In practice, it almost never happens. It's become even more of a punchline, as you say, in this administration, because the White House has repeatedly tried to program infrastructure weeks where they drive towards that single message throughout this presidency, and Trump almost always sabotages it with some kind of tweet or controversy, and it gets buried. So there was this meeting in the White House, as you say, between the top Democrats and the president. They came up with this $2 trillion number. It looks like, okay, something could get done, but you have to, you know, show me when it happens, because there are so many impediments. First of all, the question of how you pay for this, that's always a problem between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans typically want some very large private financing coming into this. Democrats want the government to pay for it. Then how do you finance it? We've already got ballooning deficits. The national debt is rising. And we have this atmosphere, this toxic atmosphere in Washington, whereby the Democrats are accusing members of the president's administration of lying to Congress. And you have this obstructive effort across the board by the White House to thwart the Democrats' investigation. So given all of that, it seemed you'd have to be a real optimist to think, really, that this could happen. Having said that, the Democrats want to have something to take to their voters, to say this is a dividend of you putting us in office in the midterm elections. The president wants to go to Midwestern states and say, I've spent billions of dollars upgrading your highways in the election. So there are political reasons why it could happen. It just seems that the conditions in Washington make it much more complicated than it would be even in normal circumstances, when it's already difficult to get infrastructure done.
Question, Molly, about the deficits and the debt surging, as Steve said. This is also an administration who thinks that's not even a big deal. I mean, the president's acting chief of staff's former budget director, Mulvaney, said, well, nobody cares about this stuff. It's staggering to have Republicans saying things like this.
And Mulvaney himself was enormously concerned about the deficit before he came into this administration, as he himself admits. He has somewhat changed his tune. You know, when Donald Trump ran for president, and we talked about this earlier, he did not run as a typical Republican. And one of the ways he didn't run as a typical Republican was this interest in using the government to build things. He's a builder. That's his background. And he has always been very enthusiastic about spending government money and not so concerned about things like cutting back on Social Security and so on. So this is an area where he actually may be more in line ideologically with the Democrats than with at least the historical ideology of his own party. But the devil is always in the details. And we have seen with this administration, as Stephen mentioned, it's always been harder after the president has this nice meeting where he says whatever people want to hear to actually work out a piece of legislation. But this meeting was surprisingly successful, surprisingly positive, given the atmospherics, given how poisonous the relationship between
nobody
the parties
stormed
is.
Out like this.
Not only did nobody
past,
storm out, yeah. The president seemed downright enthusiastic about the proposals coming from the Democratic Party, and he, in fact, committed to $2 trillion in federal spending on infrastructure. Now, and they agreed to meet again in a couple of weeks, and the administration is supposed to come forward with a proposal to pay for it. I think one sticking point is going to be that the way the Democrats would like to pay for it is by unraveling the tax cut, and I doubt you will see them go for that.
I did want to talk briefly about this latest shooting at a synagogue in Southern California. This one could have been a lot worse. One person killed, three injured. The broader point is that these attacks, it's not just on the Jewish faith, of course. We've seen these terrible attacks on Christian, on churches, mosques. It seems to be accelerating. Why?
It's a good question. And it's not just in the United States. It's around the world. Yeah. We had the Sri Lanka attack, the Christchurch attack in recent times. I mean, what this is doing is it's starting a debate about whether certain politicians who use racial and cultural and religious imagery and rhetoric in their campaigns are creating a culture whereby some people see almost permission to carry out some of these extremist attacks. We've had the president say that he doesn't see a problem or a rise in white nationalism. That goes against all the statistics that his own government has put out. So the question is, why is this happening? Is it somehow connected to a very volatile political climate, which, as I say, certain politicians, sometimes including the president, are whipping up for their own political gain?
All right, we'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Stephen Collinson, he's senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time. So nice to meet you, Molly. This program was produced by Patrice Martin, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks for joining us.